Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Living Proof's dry shampoo is so good at actually cleaning hair that you can take a spin class and not wash your hair after. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the Living Proof. And by Squarespace, providing tools that help people showcase their passions with a customized landing page, website, or online store. Also offering domains, hosting, and 24/7 support. Get your free trial at squarespace.com/modernlove. You should. Squarespace.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. The biggest decisions in our life often come down to leaps of faith, changing careers, moving cross-country, and of course, deciding to spend the rest of your life with someone. This week, actor and poet Amber Tamblyn, known for The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants and 127 Hours, brings us the story of a leap so dramatic, it's as if it were straight out of a movie. Here she is reading Kelly Thomas's essay, Ready to Take a Faithful Leap.
As we floated in a Moroccan-tiled pool on the outskirts of Palm Springs, California, my boyfriend of 3 months told me about an old English custom in which two people are married if they chant, I marry thee, 3 times, clap in unison, and kiss. Finding his story charming and amusing, I laughed. David and I had met on a film set in Los Angeles. Like me, he was a refugee from academia. I was attracted by his salt-and-pepper hair as much as by his insistent optimism, and we quickly developed a comfortable repartee. But that afternoon in Palm Springs, I sensed something was different. Only after a moment of awkward silence did I realize that David was proposing to me. He wanted us to make a home together. For me, the concept of home is loaded. My childhood home was an isolated farmhouse in North Texas, where I helped my father build barbed wire fences and sack cottonseed for the cattle's winter feeding, where mesquite trees grew like weeds and yellowed pastures stretched for miles. But most of all, home had been a place dominated by my mother's unpredictable bouts of depression, a place that, for as long as I could remember, I wanted to escape. While I focused on grades, test scores, and a life beyond rural Texas, my mother fantasized about my wedding to some well-heeled hometown boy who would one day make her a proud grandmother. She envisioned a fancy banquet-style dinner that would put her own Spartan wedding ceremony and rec room punch reception to shame. This time around, as mother of the bride, she'd wear a teal cocktail dress to complement her crystal blue eyes. In these flights of fancy, she was ebullient and vivacious, the center of attention, while I was cast as her silent enabler. I played my part, believing that I possessed the unique ability to hold her desolation in check. While my father buried himself in the Sisyphean tasks of baling hay and breaking horses, my mother's mood fluctuated between manic all-night baking marathons and menacing 3-day silences. My role was to keep the peace, to somehow quiet her refrain that we'd all be better off without her. And then one day, I'd had it. As she started in again with the wedding plans, I impulsively blurted, I'm not getting married, and I'm never having children. She called me selfish. And it's true, I was selfish, for denying her the opportunity to be belle of the ball, at least in her fantasies. But more precisely, I was selfish because I aspired to a life outside of her world. Eventually, I found it when the University of Michigan offered me a fellowship. I thought my freedom would begin the moment I pulled out of the driveway. A few weeks before my planned departure, however, People magazine ran an article about a young woman abducted by a drifter while driving alone, and my mother, obsessed with the story, insisted that she accompany me to Ann Arbor. But I knew this was just an excuse. The truth was that she wanted one last chance to play out our old ways before I strayed beyond her reach. My father, an unwitting accomplice, urged me to humor her, saying that all this talk of degrees and careers made her think she didn't know me anymore, didn't know how to know me. He promised to buy me that laser printer I wanted if I'd indulge her one last time. As we drove away, my mother gushed, "We're just like Thelma and Louise." Here we go, I thought. Now she thinks we're movie stars. In more ways than I knew, she was right. We were like the title characters in the film about two women on the lam. My mother was Thelma, the pretty ingenue, eager for attention and perfectly made up after her hour-long beauty ritual. She would giggle bashfully when truckers looked her way. I, of course, was Louise, the pragmatic problem solver. With my car packed to the gills, my mission was simply to get through this last bit of emotional blackmail. Midway through our second day, we stopped for gas at a roadside station in central Ohio, 2 hours south of our destination. I asked my mother if she wanted me to drive, but she said she felt fine. Still, I sensed her despondency. Our excursion was coming to an end, and she could no longer pretend we were a couple of adolescents out on a lark. I was going where she could never go. At the climax of Thelma and Louise, when the women are trapped between a swarm of troopers and an impassable canyon, they must make a choice. Either surrender or take their own lives. Louise hesitates, but Thelma insists. Let's not get caught. Let's keep going. In solidarity, the women hold hands, gun the accelerator, and drive off the cliff where, cinematically, they're forever suspended triumphantly in midair. 20 miles later, near Bluffton, Ohio, we were the Thelma and Louise who followed the film's narrative to its inevitable conclusion when my mother drove off a highway overpass at 70 miles an hour. The car hit the side of the bridge, flipped over the guardrail, and went briefly airborne before landing upright in a shallow creek. As soon as the car landed, I knew that this was it. This was what I had always feared, that my mother would deliver on one of her threats, go out of control, beyond the pale. With one look, I saw that she had been killed by the impact, that there was nothing I could do to save her. Drenched in gasoline and terrified that the car would burst into flames, I unbuckled my seatbelt and climbed out into the water. Drivers stopped along the highway and shouted down to me. The EMTs who arrived on the scene asked me the date and the name of the president as they strapped me to a board to be lifted into an ambulance. Over time, I've gone through several iterations of how to explain what happened. First, it was an accident because I couldn't believe it was anything else. I was incredulous, stunned, bruised. The couple directly behind us reported that our car had veered right sharply without brake lights. Everyone conjectured that my mother, perfectly cognizant moments before, must have dozed off. Second, it was a wreck because that's what I was. Overcome by post-traumatic stress and fits of anxiety, I couldn't get past the fact that before and after are indelible, that certain events cleave time in two. I've come to settle on when my mother drove off a bridge. She knew and didn't know. A tarot card reader once told me that my mother had done something she felt inexplicably compelled to do. She hadn't meant to harm me. I just happened to be there, along for the ride. But perhaps it was more than an inexplicable urge, more than her desire not to get caught in a life she couldn't seem to escape. Part of me believes that my mother wanted us to be the Thelma and Louise who, in driving off a cliff, choose their relationship over life itself. Her experience of our trip was the final and most poignant of her fantasies, the one in which she and I functioned in harmony, where we could finally relate to each other. As the years passed, I stayed away from small towns and serious relationships, but slowly came to realize that ever since that fateful journey, I'd been clinging to my own sort of fantasy, in which I, unlike my mother, could have complete control over my life. If I avoided any true commitment, I would never be stuck. I would never find myself in the unthinkable position of choosing between emotional desperation and the abyss. And yet, by defining myself in opposition to her, I had in some ways become just as trapped as she had been. Only now have I begun to see that letting go and trusting in the unknown doesn't have to mean driving off a cliff. That leaps can be leaps of faith. Floating in that Palm Springs pool, I knew nothing of old English wedding traditions, but I did know that I was at another turning point in my life. Except this time, the choice was mine. I watched David next to me, smiling, a mischievous glint in his eye. Here was someone who approached life unconventionally and regarded the world with wonder. Someone with whom I could look to the future rather than fixate on the past. Together, we could create a new kind of home, one of possibility, a home I could love. Against the backdrop of blooming Joshua trees, I reached out across the clear blue water and made the leap. We clapped loudly, exuberantly.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe.
You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Amber Tamblyn reading Kelly Thomas's essay, Ready to Take a Faithful Leap. We'll hear how Kelly's doing today after the break.
I'm Katie at Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, my hair feels great, just like it used to feel before all the coloring. And not just pathetic wisps blowing in the wind, but a real head of hair to let fly with pride. I could woo Eric Clapton from the 10th row with this hair. Love, Sally. You can use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from Daniel Jones, the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, and from the author of this week's essay, Kelly Thomas.
This essay took me over a year. And I started with that phrase from my mother that has always stayed with me. We're just like Thelma and Louise. And that's the leading part of the essay for me, was to delve into that. It took me many years to just going over this narrative and many years of therapy and just trying to figure out my relationship to my mother. Writing the scene about the crash for me was therapeutic in that I really had to go back and almost in a meditative kind of way relive that experience and think about the details. It's just built into the fabric of my being.
So often when writers approach a really difficult scene, there's an impulse to write in ways that make it seem dramatic and that infuse these scenes with emotion. But to do a scene like that well, you need to just stick to facts. It's the ultimate show and don't tell. You don't need to tell and explain. You just show.
I think with that experience, I saw how something could happen unpredictably and completely change the course of a life. Things can be taken away in a split second. I received a wide range of reactions to the piece once it was published, starting first of all with my father. My father interpreted the crash as an accident. He honestly hadn't thought of it in that Thelma and Louise kind of way because he wasn't in the car with her. They had a complicated relationship going into that, even after being married 25 years. So I think we've all dealt with it in our own ways, and he's happily married now to a wonderful woman, and we all just move forward. We didn't have a wedding, David and I. He proposed, as I say in the piece, in this kind of nonchalant, sneaky David way. I thought, okay, let's do this. And about 3 months later, we were at a friend's wedding, and then we eloped. That's almost 10 years now, and he's the one who really helped me come to the point of writing this essay.
As dark as some modern love essays are, and as deep as they go, I think you'd find very few of them that feel hopeless at the end. And usually that's because the writer is figuring something out and teaching the reader and me something that we didn't know before. When they're really done successfully, that's what they do. And there's something just inherently hopeful about that kind of self-discovery.
I miss my mom sometimes. She gave me a love of story, and that's how I began to understand there was a whole world outside of this very isolated rural community that I grew up in. Now I'm actually a year older than she was when she died. So it's hard for me to imagine her going forward. But I do miss her, and there are parts of her that I feel every day in myself.
K. Kelly Thomas on her essay, Ready to Take a Faithful Leap. You also heard from Modern Love editor Dan Jones. Special thanks to Amber Tamblyn for reading this week's piece. You can see her later this year in the noir-tinged comedy Girlfriend's Day. She'll also make her directorial debut in Paint It Black, a film she also co-wrote. And you can see her throughout the spring as she tours North America in support of her latest book, Dark Sparkler. Well, we asked you to tell us about your leaps of faith, and you came through. Here's a taste.
So I moved in after knowing him for a week.
And now we've been married over 14 years.
We met on August 27th in the eye of a hurricane. His visa was up, so I took a chance on love, married him on October 14th, and that hurricane of love continues to this day.
We're turning some of these leaps of faith into a bonus episode that we'll release early next week, so stay tuned. And next week on Modern Love, Tony-nominated actor Stephen Bogardus brings us a story of seesawing sex drives.
Whether it was the excessive demand or psychological stress, sex became more obligation than joy. In 2 short years, we had completely switched roles.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. And additional music in this episode by Mike Moschetto. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.